This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a heartfelt question. How does your livelihood reflect your values? Is it the real you at home and some empty vessel grabbing all that you can get for yourself at work? Do your values just come out for your family, and it's the law of the jungle the rest of the time? Is it possible to embrace a set of values and take them into the workplace, make your work part of a bigger mission than just a single corporation?
Inside the company, some people see you as a hidden activist. Outside of the company, you're seen as shilling for the man.
That's the voice of a corporate insider working to enforce ethics and morality on management. Christine Bader learned her lessons about the challenge of taking on the mission of corporate social responsibility inside, of all places, the oil giant BP. Later this hour, her story of working with an army of dedicated corporate officers trying to make a difference from inside the corporate culture, successes and failures. Are you a hidden activist inside your company? Or are you out and part of a team that shares your values? Do your personal values and beliefs clash with the company's corporate culture? From Fort Worth, Texas, one of you says, oh, yes, I work for a religious TV station and I'm an atheist. That sounds tough. From Colorado Springs, Colorado, yes, I used to work in healthcare administration. Denying people coverage for so long made me go back to school. Thank goodness. Tell us your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Well, you may have noticed it. The issues of differing corporate values, personal and religious freedom, and the availability of healthcare services are all colliding today in the U.S. Supreme Court. For-profit companies are challenging the Affordable Care Act, saying that the mandate that requires them to buy health insurance also compels them, against their religious values, to make contraceptives available to their employees. Only insurance plans that offer a package of women's reproductive health services, including contraceptives, are allowed under the Affordable Care Act. There's an exemption for specifically religious and nonprofit employers, but this is moral and religious coercion, say these for-profit plaintiffs. Can one opt out of a federal health care program for religious reasons?
If for-profit employers are allowed to have religious objections, we could see other religious objections for other health care services.
That's Lori Sobel, women's health policy analyst for the Kaiser Family Foundation. And of course, there have been religious objections to acts of government throughout history. Is your religion something practiced in the workplace? Are employees compelled to act according to their employer's religious beliefs? Where do the religious values of a corporation lie? In the hearts of the owners or the practices of the workforce and the employee manual? Sarah Beringer Gordon is a professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us now. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is at issue here? Who is allowed to express their religious values? Is it the owners of a company? Is it the workers who have to express them? I'm a little confused.
Well, this is a difficult case in part because the companies at issue here are incorporated, they're corporations, and there's no mention of religion in their articles of incorporation, but they do, for example, Hobby Lobby is closed on Sundays, which indicates some desire to respect what they consider the Sabbath. So there are elements of religious behavior here and also elements of just plain secular profit-seeking.
Now, Hobby Lobby is, of course, one of the plaintiffs here, and they claim that they have a set of religious values, and they're evoking something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, which sets a pretty high standard for the federal government in compelling any sort of behavior. It has to meet some sort of religious standards here. Does it apply in this case?
It does apply here. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed in response to an opinion from the Supreme Court written by Justice Scalia that said a neutral and generally applicable law can be applied against religious persons and does not, unless there's hostility against the particular religion or the particular actors, does not really raise a free exercise claim. Congress was upset by that, passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was found unconstitutional as applied to the states. So if we were talking about New York State here, for example, the company would probably not have a case. On the other hand, it still applies against the federal government, which is, of course, the source of the Affordable Care Act.
Are the Supreme Court justices being asked to decide if corporations as people, in the abstract they are considered people, that they can also have a religion?
That's part of the case. If they want to reach that, I think they certainly could. And there's nothing that I think has prepared us for this, honestly. There's no clear precedent other than the fact that 4 years ago in the Citizens United case, the same Supreme Court found that individual corporations did have First Amendment speech rights. So it's the same amendment, only this time the religion clauses.
What will the government argue, or the people on the other side, the lawyers on the other side, what will they argue in this case?
Well, and you heard Lori Sobel talk about floodgates. In other words, if we let this through, there's no end of what will happen. It's also the case that even the plaintiffs in this case don't really agree which birth control they object to. And we have not yet had a trial that would require the plaintiffs to lay out some scientific evidence. Right now, they're just claiming that the act imposes a burden, and we're at a very early stage. So in some sense, this is presenting the case before it's fully developed.
Are these folks trying to be conscientious objectors to the Affordable Care Act in some sense, just raising a religious objection and saying, I get to be opted out of this thing?
Oh, yes, they most certainly are. And this is not a new fight. The fight over women's reproduction is a very old fight in this country. And this is replaying it in yet one more venue.
Sarah Beringer Gordon is professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So arguments inside the courtroom, messages, religious and political, outside the courtroom. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has spent the day with the demonstrators and plaintiffs outside the courtroom. He joins us now from Capitol Hill. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So I want to give people a sense of what you experienced being among these political messengers, not making an argument so much as portraying what it is they think is at stake in this case. Here are two clips of tape. One is clearly from the plaintiffs here, Hobby Lobby, and the other not so clear. I'll play both of them and you can tell us, you can fill in the blanks for us.
The choice the government has forced on us is unfair and not in keeping with the history of our great nation founded on religious freedom. We believe that Americans don't lose their religious freedom when they open a family business.
I think that's freedom. I do believe that a business is also reflects the owners. They do. I mean, there's no way you can drop all your beliefs when you walk across a threshold.
There among the demonstrators, that's one plaintiff, it sounds like, and one demonstrator talking about corporate values at stake in this case. What did you experience, Todd?
That's right, John. The first woman you heard from was Barbara Green, co-founder of Hobby Lobby, just after she defended the courthouse steps. And she made her position pretty clear that she's the majority shareholder of that corporation, or at least the plurality shareholder, and doesn't leave her values at the door. And the protest you heard was Renee Piller. She's from Ashburn, Virginia, former retired airline worker and political activist, really described herself as an anti-abortion activist. And it was interesting talking to her and some of the other protesters too, because you could probably predict, John, many of the protesters on both sides out there in the snow, in the plaza, in front of the Supreme Court, were sort of the traditional anti-abortion, right-to-life protesters, anti-Obamacare folks, and pro-abortion, pro-access, Planned Parenthood-type folks, and many of them pro-Obamacare, which was interesting because, as you just covered with the last guest, it's really not what this case is about. The case is really about whether corporate business entities have those same First Amendment rights that are protected for individuals in the Constitution.
So then before we go, this case will be decided on legal issues that has no bearing on the kinds of passions that you saw outside the courtroom. This is a showcase for an argument that is going to play itself out in the congressional elections in 2024.
John, some of the people who came out of the courtroom, I should tell you, did say that they thought, again, this case would turn on Justice Anthony Kennedy, that the court appeared to be 4-4 and it's questioning with Kennedy in the balance. Of course, we never know how that's going to turn out. But you're right. The broader politics of Obamacare. We know that Republicans have chosen the Affordable Care Act as their cudgel in this midterm election. If this case goes their way, it's just another bullet for them to say this law needs to be repealed and overturned. And that would probably help them in November.
The case outside the courtroom from Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You bet.
history of TV and the history of the NCAA tournament coincide, which makes sense if you consider the billions the NCAA tournament brings from the CBS coverage each year. Our more modest parallel TV character competition continues today. The bracket elimination round three of voting. Yesterday, Tony Soprano of the series that bears his name obliterated Saul Goodman of Breaking Bad. It wasn't close.
It's an honor.
You can see all the specific vote counts at thetakeaway.org and see the other elimination results on the way to crowning a champion best TV character of all time. Some members of our staff are happy and some not so much. And so the games continue. Today entering the arena, two members of our staff, one defending Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Olivia Pope from the ABC series Scandal.
Who's the greatest TV character of all time?
Who can turn the world on with her smile?
Mary Richards of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. She didn't just turn the world on with her smile. She also showed the world that there was more than one way for a woman to win at life, to be happy, and to build and define a family.
What is a family, anyway? They're just people who make you feel less alone and really loved.
She excelled at her job.
Well, I just want to say to you, Mary Richards, thanks for doing the job so well.
And she had a rich dating life, not because she thought she needed to find a husband, but because it was fun.
Would you like to come in for some coffee?
Yeah, sure.
And, of course, she was both a feminist and a fashion icon.
It sure shows off your skin.
Mary was smart and sincere, funny and fearless, and so groundbreaking that Tina Fey, Candace Bergen, and Oprah Winfrey all cite her as a role model.
Thank you, Mary, for being such an inspiration to us all.
And what other TV character has been honored in song by both Sammy Davis Jr. and Joan Jett? Vote Mary Richards, because you love her, and because you love winning.
Olivia Pope of Scandal is a bold anti-hero and TV's fiercest woman, which is why she's TV's greatest character. She's a crisis management consultant, a fixer, someone a politician might call if they're in one of these situations.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
She's part lawyer, part PR spin machine.
I don't have to answer to you. I have to produce for you. And I do not take on anything I know I won't win. And I will win this.
It's not about justice. It's about protecting her client by any means necessary.
We're never done. If we lose this round, we prep him for appeal. If we lose that, we prep him for a second appeal, because whatever happens, there's always another move.
But like any truly good anti-hero, she has a fatal weakness.
Mr. President.
I like that.
But what makes her great is that she fights back, even with the man she loves, the leader of the free world.
I am not a toy you can play with when you're bored or lonely or horny. I am not the girl the guy gets at the end of the movie.
So in between an impossible love affair, the murder cover-ups, the national media spins, and treason against the Republic, she is just Olivia Pope. So vote for Olivia Pope from Scandal at thetakeaway.org.
That's Takeaway culture producer Kristen Meinzer and digital editor TJ Raphael on Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Olivia Pope from Scandal. Go kibitz about the brackets at thetakeaway.org or call us with your suggestion at 8778-MY-TAKE. The voting is up to you. That's where you go to our website at thetakeaway.org and vote today. Who is next? The world is asking that question. The G7 nations are just putting together a response to the annexation of Crimea, and the question is already on the table. If this was just the opening...
What will Putin do now? I don't know. We don't know what he's going to do. But we know he has the military in a position where he could go into eastern Ukraine, at least, and he's threatening other small nations in the region.
Is he threatening or welcoming? That's Senator John McCain there. The Russian speaker's in the territory of Transnistria. A small strip of land between Moldova and Ukraine with just 500,000 inhabitants would love to follow Crimea into Russia. In 1990, the region declared independence from Moldova, and in 2006, 97% of its residents voted to join Russia. Moscow has never formally recognized that vote, and last week, Transnistria's leaders asked Russia's parliament to reconsider its request to join the Russian Federation. Joe Parkinson has been covering this. He's Istanbul bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Joe, welcome.
Good to be here.
So is this a detail left over from the 1990s and 2006, or is this something that escalates this crisis?
That's the question on everyone's lips, and it's one that's yet to be determined. It's interesting that you had that section from John McCain in your introduction. He's certainly warning that Moldova could be the next domino. And inside Transnistria itself, as you say, a territory with a lot of Russian speakers that's been a de facto client state of Moscow since 1990, people there who want a closer relationship with what Russia would like to be absorbed into the Russian Federation certainly see this as an opportunity. Whether Vladimir Putin decides that he wants to send more troops to back up the 1,500 or so Russians that are already based there and escalate tensions further by becoming much closer to the European Union is, at the moment, as I said, anyone's guess.
Well, there are two issues here, it seems to me, looking at the map. One is a kind of an encirclement issue in the sense that this inflames the sense of vulnerability of Ukraine, possibly. And why are the troops that are already there stationed inside this territory in Moldova?
Well, this was one of those kind of hangovers from the breakup of the Soviet Union. There was so much going on in 1989 and afterwards that some ethnic conflicts or, you know, territorial conflicts that fled barely made it onto people's radar. Transnistria was one, the territory formally split from the then Soviet Republic of Moldova in 1990. Another one, something like Nagorno-Karabakh, which we have between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus, and South Ossetia, which is now, as you know, part of a war that was fought between Georgia and Russia in 2008. So, you know, the Russian troops have been there as peacekeepers, as a peacekeeping force. They're very much welcomed by the local population. And they're a fact on the ground that even if there's no escalation, will enable, you know, Vladimir Putin to have leverage and some degree of encirclement of Ukraine, as you say. If there was more troop deployment, there is no airport in Moldova. And what some analysts and even the NATO Air Force general over the weekend says he's worried about is troops that are amassing on the East Ukrainian border, marching across to Transnistria and forming some kind of land barrier, cutting the new Ukrainian administration off from the Black Sea. Now, that is a very alarmist scenario. It's one that I think, you know, isn't part of people's best guess scenarios for now, but it's certainly something that is possible, and it seems something that military planners are considering.
So at this point, the Russian troops that are in Transnistria have no mandate like the troops in Crimea to protect Russians from possible terrorists, but if more troops were to move in, then suddenly this is a whole different ballgame?
Yes. And to be honest, there's unlikely to be a need to protect the Transnistrian community because 97% of them voted in a referendum to strengthen ties with the Russian Federation. You know, as I said, they're very much there by the support of the population. But if Vladimir Putin decided that Russian communities across eastern Ukraine, southern Ukraine, we know there's a big Russian population in Odessa, which is very close to the Transnistrian border. If he decides that they need protection, then troops could conceivably begin marching across.
This Transnistria situation here, before we go, is very, very interesting because in 2006, apparently, Vladimir Putin decided that if he had an impulse to go into Transnistria or to acquire that territory, he was constrained by something. It would appear that that constraint has gone away based on what's going on in Crimea. How do you think things have changed between now and 2006?
Well, 2006, it seemed like a very different geopolitical situation. What we have right now is a very different choreography in Moscow. We have a much more nationalist attempt to rebuild a former empire. And Vladimir Putin, because he seems to be, you know, basking in the new popularity of this expansionist rhetoric and this, you know, annexation of Crimea, he may be creating a beast that he needs to feed in order to maintain popularity. And the easiest next domino, arguably, for him to annex, where there's a population that wants a closer relationship with Russia, is in Transnistria. However, you know, if he was to move into Transnistria, because as I said, there's no airport, there's no way they can fly troops in, they would have to move across Ukraine. And that's a very, very worrying prospect for the Europeans and for the planners in Washington.
Joe Parkinson, Istanbul bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Back to our discussion at the top of the hour about corporate values and personal values. Do you and your boss see eye to eye on questions of values? From Jacksonville, Florida, when I worked for a large commercial bank, the values clashed, and so much so that I left a year ago to start my own business, and I've never been happier. Or from Portland, Oregon, quite the contrary. I work at a small web design firm in Portland, Oregon, and we have a pretty amazing office culture. Not only does our company offer complete flexibility to work remotely, but on the days I do work from the office, my dog comes with me. She even has her own picture and bio on our company's website. We have a kegerator, full kitchen and lounge in the office. Such flexibility and perks don't work for everyone, but with my personality and lifestyle, I couldn't ask for better circumstances. Sounds like you're doing okay up there in Portland. From Sarasota, Florida, somewhat yes. I'm a dental hygienist working for a periodontist. We attempt to practice minimally invasive therapies, which I do agree with. However, I would prefer that our post-treatment therapies also be minimal. We should have natural alternative options available instead of just conventional medications, antibiotics, and chemotherapeutics. You can tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Earlier this hour, it was a discussion of some perceived moral complications for corporations to sign up for the Affordable Care Act in arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now a discussion of some execution problems for the ACA in the state of Oregon. Qualms about morality don't explain the reluctance of Oregonians to use that state's Affordable Care Act sign-up website. Despite Oregon's traditional engagement on healthcare issues, its website has been ranked a disaster even by locals enthusiastic about Obamacare. Christian Foden-Vensel, reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting, joins us. Christian, welcome back.
Hi.
So negative reviews for the website. It's not the only game in town as far as the Affordable Care Act is concerned, right?
No. When the website broke down and they couldn't get it going, they had a system where you could enroll via a letter. So they sent out a letter to lots of people who could get onto Medicaid, and you just signed the letter, send it back. So they have enrolled a lot of people that way. I think like maybe 100,000, something like that. So that was a workaround that they worked on pretty soon. And then once the website really didn't work, they had to figure out how to do it. So they, when you go on the website, you check out what you want, but then you have to download a PDF and fill in all your information and send it in that way. That is if you want to do it by yourself. The other way that, and they have enrolled about 157,000 people through the website, but you have to sit with somebody else, so what they call a navigator, who has to do everything for you. So and it doesn't look like by the end of when March 31st rolls around that anybody will be able to be sitting there by themselves and just work through the website. So it's been a bit of a failure here.
What do you think the impact has been on enrollment overall, and we are, as you mentioned, coming up to the deadline?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard to know exactly, but there are a lot of people here who have enrolled. I think Oregonians were, you know, very gung-ho for the law. And so when the website didn't work, they have gone to navigators and they have gone around various ways. I mean, it's a bit like if you decided to buy a radio, John, and, you know, you had to go to Best Buy and their website wasn't working. Well, you just drive there and you go and buy it. And I think that's what a lot of people have done. It's like, well, okay, it's a website. That doesn't work. But I still need the health insurance. So I'm going to go and I'm going to go through these various processes. So I think all told, we've got about 290,000 people who have enrolled, which puts us kind of in the middle of the pack. I think Oregon expected to and wanted to be at the front of the pack. But, you know, the website has been terrible, but people have signed up anyway.
But it's a very Oregon-like back to the land solution there. You know, and I don't even know if Best Buy sells radios anymore. That's also very low tech, Christian.
I'm just looking for something to explain it. But yes, we like it that things are nice and simple here.
The local issue, though, that will survive after the deadline is the contracting arrangement with Oracle. That's really going to be the scandal statewide.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a big problem with Oracle. They basically got a very good contract for themselves, and it said basically that you have to pay on time, and secondly, the deliverables, you can't hold us accountable. You still have to pay if we don't deliver the deliverables. Now, Cover Oregon, the health insurance website, did try and change that, and it looks like Oracle said, hey, we're walking away if that doesn't, if you don't stick with the contract. And as you can imagine, you know, you've got a really complex website, and if they walk away, you're left there with nothing. It doesn't doesn't work. Yeah. So they kind of had the state over a barrel there. And Oregon, because people were so gung-ho about the idea, we wanted a Cadillac website. We wanted everything in there from the Affordable Care Act to the Healthy Kids Initiative here, for example, that we have, and other programs. So we had a one-stop shop.
And it sounds like Oracle was very happy to oblige, giving you at least a Cadillac-priced website. The rest will have to be sorted out. Christian, thanks so much.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you.
Christian Foden-Wenzel is a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Passions over the tragedy and confusion surrounding Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 erupted into rare public anger today in Beijing. Family members from Flight 370 are rejecting yesterday's sudden declaration by Malaysian authorities that Flight 370 crashed into the Indian Ocean off the coast of Australia. Ahmad Yohari Yayab, the CEO of Malaysia Airlines, told the BBC today that the airline has done everything possible for the families.
Our primary role in this tragedy is really to ensure we really take care of the family of those on board. And I think we've gone beyond our normal responses. I think we've done all we can within our means to help them.
But the families of the missing in China aren't buying it and took their protest to the doors of the Malaysian embassy in Beijing. LA Times Beijing bureau chief Barbara Demick was at the protests in Beijing. She joins us now. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you.
So who isn't buying the Malaysian explanation? I gather this protest was orchestrated and that the Chinese have some criticism for the Malaysians as well at this point.
Well, yes, the protest seemed to have an official stamp of approval on it, as any public protest does in China. I mean, obviously, protests are not tolerated in this country. And when one happens, especially at a foreign embassy, it usually means the Chinese government is encouraging it. And in this case, I think the Chinese government wanted to allow the families to vent their anger for various reasons, maybe to prevent the anger from being turned towards the Chinese government.
Barbara, what are the issues for the families besides simply venting?
I think the families have some genuine anger. They've heard so many different explanations from the Malaysian government that they're, you know, confused and exhausted. And when the prime minister took to the airwaves our last night, you know, a 10 p.m. press conference, very unusual, everybody was expecting that they found debris from this plane, and to hear only that there was a new analysis of satellite data that, you know, it made it clear beyond a shadow of a doubt, which was maybe unfortunate wording that the prime minister used, that there were no survivors. That didn't sit well with the families. At this point, having waited more than 2 weeks, I think they wanted something more final than that.
So do they have a suspicion that something's being covered up, withheld from them, some information?
You know, I don't know that it's a specific bit of information they think is missing, but they feel like they've not been told everything on a timely basis, and I don't think they understand, at least not emotionally, why it's taken 2.5 weeks to get to this point.
How worried are Chinese authorities that this political protest against the Malaysians might be directed at the way the Chinese authorities have handled this?
I think that's behind the scenes, a bit of a factor. You know, the Chinese have looked pretty lame themselves. They were, you know, their internal propaganda the past few years has been that they dominate the South China Sea and that they're this great rising naval power. But I think this search has shown, that the U.S. still rules the seas, that the U.S. has the best satellite intelligence along with the UK and Australia, and China made a few kind of silly moves, the release of satellite data showing wreckage in the South China Sea that turned into a red herring. I mean, that didn't look so good. I don't think they've given their own citizens a lot of confidence on this one either.
Barbara Demick is L.A. Beijing bureau chief, speaking to us from Beijing on the passions of family members of the victims and missing from Malaysian Flight 370. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, the Crazy Nights of playwright Tennessee Williams, at the top of his game here in Streetcar Named Desire.
You know, Stella spoke a good deal about you. She said you were married once, weren't you?
Yes. Well, I was quite young. The boy died.
Vivian Leigh, Marlon Brando, immortalized by Tennessee Williams' words. But it was another crazy night Tennessee wrote about as a much younger writer in a little story called Crazy Night. Quote, "It was the last night of the spring term, and it was called Crazy Night because everyone on that night has his last fling for the year. It was rather like New Year's Eve, except that it marked the end of something old without celebrating the beginning of anything new. And for that reason, though it was feverishly gay on the surface, it was really the saddest night of the year." This never-before-published Tennessee Williams short story comes out of the archives today in The Strand magazine. Andrew Gulley, managing editor of The Strand, found the story in the Ransom Library at the University of Texas, a simple, drunken, love-found-and-love-lost story about college life. But Gulley says it contains some strong hints of the things to come from a young genius.
I would call it more of a tragic story. At the heart of it, Williams sort of shows us about how us human beings idealize others. And at the end, we often fall prey to disappointment when we find that the people we're putting our stock in, a lot of our feelings towards, prove to be very human.
What period do you think this is from in Tennessee Williams' writing life? Are you able to know that with any certainty?
Well, I have a guess, and I would say it would be when he was about under the age of 25. When he was about 26, 27, he took on the name Tennessee. And looking through the original manuscript, it signed at the end Thomas Lanier Williams. So that was how he had signed a lot of his works before he was age 27, 28.
You know, it feels like a young piece. It feels like someone just getting started who certainly has some confidence. But it also feels like he certainly acquired later his confidence with the big issues that he wrote about in the famous plays.
You know, you brought up an excellent point, John, in that with this Tennessee Williams story, you can see a great narrative voice. You can sense a sympathy for his characters. You can see some of the themes that he was starting to grapple with, but which had not completely gone into place until he was in his late 20s.
What do you think the intermingling is between the themes of a story like this and some of his more famous dramatic work?
Well, the plays that he wrote were able to give him an opportunity to say things that he could not say in a short story. I think in Williams's mind, a short story was a sketch, a sort of a one-act play written in prose form and short story form, which would give him an opportunity to take us into situations where the mechanics of a play would be very difficult to write about. You could see this sort of a story where it revolves from a dorm room to a barn to several places in quick succession would not be very effective if it was a play, even a one-act play, just by the mere mechanics of it. So his short stories, in essence, were a sketch. They were something that had some of the themes that he had written about, but were more along the two or three character variety, where his plays would often have six or seven major characters. And they also were, in my view, very effective because there was more introspection in his short stories. And the introspection was something where obviously you can never have in a play because people are just speaking and you cannot have an opportunity to hear what they're thinking or read what they're thinking.
So what in this story really speaks to you in the voice of Tennessee Williams? A favorite line, something that caused you to go, aha?
I would say, John, that one of the things that I found interesting was that you could sort of see this theme of disappointment, which he ended up expanding upon when he wrote The Rose Tattoo, where the character of Serafina has revered her husband, Rosario, who had passed away years earlier, and she had looked upon him as this almost religious figure who she had worshipped, only to find that he had cheated on her when they were married. And what really stuck out about Crazy Night was how the character of this young Tennessee Williams, even though he calls himself Phil in this story, had looked upon Anna Jean, his romantic interest, in a way as if she, when she, at the point when he suspected that she was not in love with him, he was looking at everything in a dark, dreary, depressive way. And when his love with her is consummated, the whole world seems to be different. And I think the story is very autobiographical.
And why do you think that?
Well, I was reading, of course, his memoirs and his notebooks. And Williams goes into a lot of details about his past relationships. And he makes a passing reference to what he calls a very short relationship in college with a girl named Anna Jean. And that does not go anywhere at all in his memoirs or his notebooks. But he goes on in detail about some other relationships that he had had. So looking at this story, perhaps this story is the missing piece in the puzzle about his relationship in college with Anna Jean, which he might not have written about in his memoirs or his notebooks because it might have been very painful to him.
And you can feel that pain and certainly imagine that mystery being solved by reading this story, Crazy Night.
Exactly. I mean, probably one of the reasons why I chose this story over all the others was because I felt it was the most autobiographical of the stories that I had found.
And what line do you love from this story that even as a magazine editor, you would never take out?
The line that I liked, and you're gonna think that this is a little insane. When one has unlearned his last belief, he stands. And to me, when I read that, I said to myself, in many levels, it doesn't make sense. But in another level, I looked at it and I said to myself, this was sort of the chatter of drunken youths, which I'm very far away from now.
Although to have unlearned one's last belief, do you think that's a synonym for disillusionment?
I think so. And I think that foreshadows the ending of the story without giving a lot of the story away.
Andrew Gullia is managing editor of The Strand magazine. He spoke to us from Michigan. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, John.
A man-made disaster 9 years ago. The world went up in flames in Texas City, Texas.
There was nothing you could recognize, nothing. Everything was just torn to bits. It was probably outside the military, the worst thing you'll ever see. It was hell on earth.
The 2005 Texas City refinery disaster portrayed in that documentary excerpt, it was at a BP facility formerly owned by Amoco. It killed 15 people, injured 170 others, including members of that victim's family speaking there. There were criminal violations, people's lives in this oil town were shattered, and inside BP, a young corporate officer made a disturbing personal discovery about her job.
Looking back on that time, I realized that I fell into a number of common traps. So I was working on human rights at BP, but I think there's a common misperception that human rights is something that we talk about developing countries. It's about dictatorships and repressive regimes. It's certainly not something that happens in the U.S. with unionized workforces. So I think that was a real mistake. Obviously, looking back, I realize I could have tried harder to engage more senior people across the company. And I'm trying to strike a balance between really blaming myself or giving myself too much credit for what I might have been able to do, because who knows?
The voice of Christine Bader, a former employee of BP, tasked to make sure that the oil company was considering community values in its building and safety policies. Sometimes she succeeded, sometimes she failed. Her story of trying to be an activist for moral and social responsibility both inside and outside the corporate world is told in her new book, The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil. Bader says even though she wishes that oil companies could better anticipate the consequences of their actions, she says companies do respond to disasters.
Think of iconic, bad, disastrous corporate situations. And what comes to mind first? Shell in Nigeria. There was another similar situation where ExxonMobil in Aceh, their liquefied natural gas plant, had to shut down for 4 months. I couldn't find an exact estimate, but I found a number of different estimates that talked about how much that cost the company. It was anywhere from $100 to $350 million. These are serious impacts on the company. So companies would do well to be proactive to try to prevent some of these things from happening in the first place.
Why did you decide to write a manifesto for a corporate officer for social responsibility? Is that something that you culled together from a lot of conversations with members of this informal army, or is this a personal mission?
It's a little bit of both. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from Dave Stangus, who's the vice president for sustainability at Campbell's Soup. And he used to work at Intel Corporation. And he said, those of us who have been doing this work for a while, we used to think we needed to evangelize. We used to think, oh, if we could just get everybody to think like us, to embrace sustainability and see the world our way. And he said, we've realized that just doesn't work anymore. So when he came into Campbell's, his CEO said, okay, let's jot down our big goals on the back of a napkin and then we'll announce them to everybody and then you work with everybody to implement them. And Dave said, they're going to hate me if we do that, and it's not going to work. Give me some time. Let me go around and meet all the department heads, listen to what motivates them, what drives them, what they're measured on, and then we can think about how what we want to get done supports what they do, and then they'll own it, and then they'll implement it, which is what has happened.
Is there a sort of cultural identifier for people like you inside a corporation where you walk by and go, oh, that's the responsibility person. Yeah, kind of preachy. Where's the sensible shoes, you know, that sort of thing.
There's a little bit of that. But I think that's part of the challenge is that inside the company, some people see you as a hidden activist. Outside of the company, you're seen as shilling for the man. So I think that part of the challenge, part of the balance is that inside the company, sure, you want to be seen as promoting these beliefs. And why should you have to hide that? But you do need to do this translation job of figuring out how it supports the business.
One of the elements of your manifesto seems really wise to me, and I'm curious as to how you figured this out. You say that if what you're doing depends on a leadership change, a shift at the highest level, new CEO, that sort of thing, you're not doing your job. It actually should be so embedded that any leadership would see that what you're doing is valuable.
That's exactly right. So the problem with the way that a lot of corporate social responsibility or corporate citizenship initiatives have evolved is that they're the whim of a CEO or the CEO's wife attended some benefit and came back in and thought, oh, this is a good idea. We should throw some money at it. And not to say that they're not contributing to good causes, but in a financial downturn with a leadership transition, those things will just go away. And the organizations and the communities that might have benefited from that giving are left out in the cold. So what I want to see is companies investing in projects that are linked to their business that will be sustainable over the long term.
One of your manifesto items speaks, it seems, directly to people coming out of business school filled with idealism. Revolutionary change is transformative, and that's great, but incremental change is good too. How do you reconcile the two of those?
So I came into BP right out of business school, really idealistic and energetic and thinking I'm going to change the world. And a lot of the corporate idealists that I spoke with for my book did too. But we've realized that the day-to-day is pretty small and it's pretty incremental. And there are these moments of opportunities for transformation. Some of them have contributed to new industry initiatives that you know are actually going to move a whole bunch of companies around the world at the same time. But the day-to-day, these small steps look pretty small. So things like launching a new corporate policy or signing on to an initiative, those things to the outside world seem really small, but a lot has to happen inside the company for those things to happen. You have to get the right people aligned. You have to have made the case to certain departments. So that was actually part of what came out of the book in trying to reconcile the BP that emerged in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, with the BP that I thought I knew so well, that I got to know in Indonesia and China, that was doing these really innovative, transformative investments in communities around those big projects, to try to reconcile those two, I realized that, okay, I did not transform the whole of BP, but I know I made a difference to those few hundred families that I worked with.
Has anyone ever told you you've sold out?
Oh, sure. Sure. I get that all the time. But talking to a lot of the corporate idealists, you need people within companies to be pushing for change. And you also need people outside protesting, banging on the door. We need people pulling every possible lever to make change happen. And some of those people have to be inside corporations.
Christine Bader is the author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Erin Hobaugh, Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. Do your personal values and beliefs clash with the company's corporate culture? Yes, I believe in being honest and straightforward with the employees. That is not what is going on at all. The company seems to think that it's okay to lie to these people, even with their employment. That's one of the biggest issues I have.
The boss may be listening there, Erin. Here's a story from Hannibal, Missouri. Yes, I am pro-choice, working for an anti-choice substance abuse rehabilitation center for underprivileged women. The clash is resounding and deeply frustrating, considering our clients. Another one from Meadville, Pennsylvania. I'm a Democratic official swimming in the pond of a Republican county courthouse, yet somehow we all get along. Message of peace there, world harmony. From Meadville, Pennsylvania. Share your story at 877-8MYTAKE or at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, vote in our takeaway brackets for the greatest TV character of all time. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.